It's lovely to see everyone. And my name is Joshin, I think most of you know. And I wanted to, this morning, continue the conversation that Concho, our wonderful Shuso, last week opened up. When he presented the koan, was it Hwangpo or Obaku? Hwangpo. About there being no teachers of Zen. Remember, he told the monks, you gobblers of dregs, you're running around here and there wanting to hear, holding on to these teachings. And how can you have the day when you do that? So one of the monks said, but how can you say there are no teachers of Zen? What are you calling the people who give talks and lead practice groups? And Longpo apparently said, I do not say there is no Zen, only no teachers of Zen. Which begs the question, what is Zen? And we're lucky that somebody else asked that question, not of the same teacher, but the answer was the heart mind that asks that question is Zen. And so, yeah, how can we teach that? So where I want to continue from where our good Shuso left off is, if there are no teachers, then can there be a path? Path is something, isn't it, that others have walked on. So they leave the traces that we can follow, so that we don't have to bushwhack our way through and can save time. And we certainly know from the literature, don't we, from all our Zen ancestors, about their moments of awakening, the moments that brought them to see reality, our true nature, the way things are. We have, what, Tokusen's, somebody blows out a candle and leaves him in total darkness. This guy who had seen himself as an expert on the sutras. When the teacher snatches light or his way of normal way of seeing things away, and he's left in darkness, and suddenly he knows who he is. Or we have the example of Wineng, the sixth ancestor, who, when he hears the first line, he hears a woodsman singing the first line of the Diamond Sutra, the mind abides nowhere, or the mind that abides nowhere. And he's suddenly awakened. And this is even before he starts practice. Joshu had his wonderful exchange with Nansen. And he's asking Nansen, what is the way? And Nansen answers, ordinary mind is the way. Joshu asked, well, shall I try to seek after it or not? Nansen said, if you try for it, you will become separated from it. But how can I know the way if I don't try for it? Nansen answers, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing is confusion. When you've really reached the true way, beyond all doubt, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. How can it be talked about on a level of right and wrong? At these words, Joshua was enlightened. And then he spent the next 30 years trying to clarify his experience, to stabilize it. So ordinary mind is the way, the mind that simply allows us to tend to what comes up as we go along, tying our shoelaces, brushing our teeth, answering an email. As Layman Pong would say, carrying wood, fetching water, how marvelous. And so we hear the Sandokai, when you walk the way, it is not near, it is not far. If you are deluded, you're mountains and rivers away from it. So we're deluded when we say, this should not be happening to me right now. How dare they treat me in this way? Why isn't that cab coming? I called it 10 minutes ago. So we have the things that happen to us, don't we? And then we have all of our interpretations, all of our meaning making, which is what causes the suffering. Because it's happening to me personally, and I am taking personal offense at how the universe is dealing with me. So, what is the way? There's this marvelous poem by Antonio Machado. Brings me back, God, how many years now? 40 years maybe, when I was a Spanish major. So I'll give you the Spanish, not to be pretentious, but just because you can hear the rhythm. It goes, caminante, son tus huellas el camino, y nada más. Caminante, wayfarer. Son tus huellas, your footsteps are the way and nothing more. Caminante, wayfarer. No hay camino. There is no way. Se hace camino al andar. The way is in the walking. The way is in the walking. So with each step, each breath, we find our life. And yet, as we know, it takes years of practice, doesn't it, to appreciate. Practice and taming a mind so it's not racing ahead, superimposing its views that we automatically latch onto and accept as the real. So each step, each breath, one moment we're born, Beckett said, and the next moment we die. Thanks to impermanence, this endless coming into being and disappearing of everything, of the whole universe, and what makes everything possible. Isn't it? That coming and going is what allows us to have hope. We have hope because of the possibilities inherent in this dynamic. That nothing is given, nothing is fixed. And this is what allows us to improvise in relation to what's happening, to play our part, to respond. And we try skillfully. We hope skillfully. So if one moment we're born and the next we die, and in between we struggle. So the question is, really, how can we relate to our life in such a way that it's not such a struggle? And wherein lies this struggle? So the first thing is, of course, is that we take this, don't we, to be, this is what we identify with as the self, my skin bag. And so there's a lot of fear right there around this creature that needs to survive. And so we notice how we feel confident when we're filled with vigor. Might even go to being cocky. So when we're on top of our game, we're competent, we feel, yeah. And then the vulnerability when we're sick or weak or feel that we're aging or we make mistakes. So there's the fear of loss of all kinds, loss of our health, loss of our memory, loss of face, the loss of control, the loss of support, the loss of our independence, the loss of coherence. All these ways where we might feel at the mercy of what we intrinsically feel is a hostile universe. What will become of me if I can't keep my performance going? And we have all these ideas, you see, don't we, thoughts about what we need, what our requirements are to feel safe. I was in Havana a couple of weeks ago, and when the cab dropped me off at the building where I was going to be staying, I found myself looking at this very derelict building at the corner next to a gas station in front of this highway. And the word seedy and then dangerous came to mind. And then I saw two cops. I expected to see heroin needles. You know, I didn't even want to look on the ground, but these two young cops then standing there to kind of confirm my worst suspicions. And at the back of my mind, of course, was this thought, I deserve better than this. And this was a refrain that, as I began to get to know Havana, over and over, I saw my entitlement, my arrogance, my privilege. And it began to feel like I was carrying around these hulking, you know, I was El Gringo writ large. It turned out, you know, this neighborhood actually was one of the more sought after neighborhoods in Havana. It was close to the ocean, sea breezes. It was where all the gay boys hung out at night to party and walk, you know, along the ocean, right, equivalent to the West Side Highway and Christopher Street. But we get to see how much baggage I bring to situations. You see how hard it is to actually be innocent, to come to fresh situations with an innocent, open mind. We have all kinds of judgments that we superimpose. And the apartment, of course, turned out to be perfectly clean and modern inside and beautiful and quite luxurious, as I deserved. But the question is, you see, if we have these ideas about what a good neighborhood looks like, we can be sure we have ideas about what a good spiritual practice looks like, or what our path should look like. And so this is one of the barriers, isn't it, to being able to be exactly with the moment as it is. If we have these judgments about what I should be experiencing in any given moment, then there are a whole panoply and array of sensations, feelings, you see, that we naturally recoil from. They're aversive. And it's sort of like, no, this is not for me. I don't, and I shouldn't have to go here. Instead, we're looking more for outcomes, experiences that will make us, that will shore us up, make us feel good, make us look good. So right now we've got somebody in the White House, don't we, who is teaching us so much about our own narcissism, isn't it? It's because it's so writ large. He's not the only one who plays the blame game, who doesn't like being a loser, who doesn't like being dismissed, discounted, disagreed with. He's not the only one who wants everyone to be on my side, to see things the way I see them. To see that we really only want to order up things on the menu that taste good. And we expend a lot of energy keeping at bay stuff that doesn't make us look good or feel good. And yet, you know, really, if there's only one rule about spiritual practice, is that we're signing up to be losers. Say, okay, this is what I'm signing up for. Sign me up, sign me on. When Musho Roshi, Nancy Baker, was here for the Urban Session, she made a remark, I think, that seems to sort of resonate in the room. She said that each of us was a reflection of the whole, absolutely unique. And she asked us to consider that, just our own uniqueness, to look around the room at each other. And see if there was anybody else in the room just like us. And it reminded me of something that Agnes Martin wrote about when she was giving advice to artists. She said, "We each of us feels that our life is not like anyone else's life." And that is absolutely true, infinitely true. She said, to live an absolutely original life, one has only to be oneself. In nature, there is no sameness anywhere. There are no two rocks alike, no days alike, no moment alike, even forever. And no two people are alike, or any moment of their lives. So she says, it follows from this that we cannot help one another, since our responses are not alike. And since we are not alike the experience, since we're not alike the experience of others is no use to us. This is particularly obvious when we wish to know what to do. Agnes Martin continues, we are all born with a certain potential. It's different from that of anyone else, and it is necessary to life. We must unfold our potential as a contribution to life. We are born to do certain things, and we are born to fill a certain need. If there's a bare spot on the ground, the best possible weed for that environment will grow. In the same way, our lives are created out of necessity. And we are created with the potential to meet the necessity. So, what would it be like for us to accept that about our lives? To accept that about everything. That where we are is exactly where we need to be. And who we are is exactly what is needed for the situation. So, to accept that what is happening is the only thing that could be happening. As we take each breath, as we put one foot before the other, as we simply respond in our lives moment to moment with our ordinary mind that is not arguing with reality, then what else can we do except bow 1,000 times a day to what is in front of us? And I for one need support. I need everyone's support to help me and remind me to do that. So that's why I'm saying it, just so you know. Yeah. Thank you all for your attention.